Good morning, everybody. All right, we've got a full room. It's pretty exciting. We're going to let our panelists talk for a little bit, and then we'll open it to questions fairly early, and then we have other questions. But welcome to Big Cost Sweeping Changes, What to Know About the IRA and IIJA. It's an exciting topic because has anybody here actually covered the IRA money? Okay, so that's a good portion, but it's hard, right? You don't know how to track it. You don't know what's being spent. There's seems to be, well, Jigar can explain this. It seems to be a bit of a lack of transparency around it. So hopefully this panel will explain what's going on and how to track it as a journalist. This panel includes, we have Jigar Shah, who's Director of Loan Programs at the U.S. DOE, who's going to give us a brief explanation of what the programs do, what the IRA, IIJ, especially in his area, what they do. Jane Patton is a campaigns manager for the U.S. Fossil Economy, for SEAL, the Center for International Environmental Law. And then we have Jesse Blazer, data and graphics reporter from Politico, and Kelsey Tamburino, energy reporter, Politico, who have done some work on this topic, and they know kind of how to, they've dug up some of the information and have done some stories on that. So they're going to show you how they do it. I am Pam Radke. I am an investigative reporter and editor at floodlightnews.org. Hopefully you all are familiar with that. And by the way, we will be, look in your email from SEJ. We're going to be putting out a call for freelance pitches for stories on the IIRA and the IIJA. So anyways, I will pass it off to Jigar to, if you want to start a little bit and tell us what is going on with the IRA and the IIJA and how the loans program fits into it.
Sure. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for having me. Maybe I just start by saying that the Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law, as well as CHIPS and Science, really has changed the trajectory of the signals that we're sending to American innovators and entrepreneurs, right? So for 40-plus years, we sort of said, you know, we're going to invent all the best stuff here in the United States, and we're going to send you to other continents to scale it up, right? And I think, you know, with the passing of these laws, we have now said, we're going to invent all the best stuff here, and we want you to actually build your first commercial facility here and tie it to the American worker. When you think about just how large that change is, you could imagine it takes a little bit of planning. And so when you think about the recent announcements just in the last couple weeks, right, whether it's the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund or whether it's the industrial decarb projects or whether it's the 48C manufacturing projects or, you know, our loan announcements for our first tribal loan and our nuclear loan with the Palisades nuclear plant restart or the Thacker Pass lithium facility in Nevada or other things that we've recently announced, you could imagine that the Inflation Reduction Act was a starting line. For many folks, it was a surprising starting line. They didn't actually know it was going to pass until the day before it passed. And so a lot of the planning work that's required takes a long time. And so there were some projects that were working before then, right, that they had been working for 5 years before then and gotten to the point where they're at. And many projects who really only were able to raise development capital from private investors after the IRA passed. And then they're now on a 1.5-year clock, et cetera, to do that. The Loan Programs Office has tried really hard to be as transparent as we can be. And so when you think about what we've done, we instituted this thing called the Monthly Application Activity Report, which I think there's a big chart there that that Lucy's showing there. And so we have been very public every month around all of the applicants to the Loan Programs Office. I can't tell you their names because of the Trade Secrets Act, but I can tell you which sectors they're in, whether it's in advanced fossil or nuclear or virtual power plants, green chemicals, you know, et cetera. And how it changes month to month. And I think Bloomberg New Energy Finance even like published like some sort of like thing on how it's changing. But also in the 2020 Energy Act, we had a mandate to be more geographically diverse. We had a lot of California-heavy portfolio from the 2009 to 2011. I'm very proud of the fact that we've got applications from across the country. We have, I think, 48 or so states and two U.S. territories that have applied. So, you know, that's been extraordinarily exciting as well. And, you know, I'd say the what's your last graphic?
Estimated remaining loan.
Oh, got it. And then the other thing that we've been very clear about is trying to be crystal clear about how much loan authority we have. I think there's a lot of folks who are going around saying, Jigar Shah has $400 billion. Those numbers don't add up to $400 billion. But like, but I appreciate people's enthusiasm. But we do have an extraordinary amount of interest in the loan programs office, and we now have additional tools by which to fill in gaps. So I think you've got the specific programs, right? So battery money from the manufacturing supply chain office, right? Transmission money, you've got industrial decarb money, direct air capture money, like you've heard all of the big announcements. But then there's gaps, right? And I think the loan programs office is one of the few places where we don't have this competitive grant program where everyone has to put in their application and 4 months goes by before you know who won and then there's a selection and award. For us, it's a rolling process. And so anyone who believes that they meet the statutory requirements of the loan programs office can come in, they can discuss their project freely, and then we can try to figure out where they fit in, how to help them. And then they still have to meet a very high bar, of course, to get through the office. But we're very excited about what the IRA has kicked off. And I do think when you look at the data from Rhodium and MIT or the work that's coming out of the CEA or Treasury or other places, I think you have seen a 3x increase in investment in this country into manufacturing and supply chain. From a 20-year average. And so it really is noticeable in the data. And I think it shows that America is getting its mojo back on, you know, in these sectors.
Let me ask you one question before we go on to Jane. How much of the IRA and IIJA is being funneled through the loans program? Would you say you have 10%, 20%?
It's a very difficult thing to answer because it depends on how you're asking it. Kelsey knows this very well. From a Congressional Budget Office score, I think our Congressional Budget Office score, I think, was something on the order of $11.5 billion out of whatever that number was that the IRA was, mm-hmm. which is trillions. And so from that perspective, we're very small. But from the perspective of catalyzing, I think we have been, you know, at the forefront of catalyzing trillion-dollar scale industries. So whether you think about EV manufacturing really would not be where it is today without the loan that we made to Tesla. You know, solar would not be here today without the first 500 megawatt plus loans that we provided there. Wind, similarly, right? Lithium ion battery manufacturing, similarly. And so when you think about all of the loans that we do, we do the first one, the second one, the third one, all of which are, you know, very hard to get commercial debt for. Mm-hmm. But then the next 10 or the next 50 or the next 100 all happen because we did the first five, right? And then that gets you to trillion-dollar scale. And for those of you who are following at home, clearly climate change will require trillion-dollar scale. And so I think that we are that very important last step into getting Wall Street and commercial banks and others interested in, you know, sort of leaning in.
Okay, great. All right, I'm going to pass it off to Jane, who's going to kind of give maybe what some of the issues are with the IIJA and the IRA.
Yeah, thanks, Pam. So as Pam said, my name is Jane Patton. I work for an organization with a very long name, the Center for International Environmental Law. I still wake up every day amazed that I get to do this job because I'm a sixth-generation Louisianian. Three generations of my family live in Louisiana right now. Four generations are buried in Louisiana. And God willing, I will also become among one of those next generations that gets to live out my life in Louisiana. It's I used to do advocacy with the U.S. State Department, and I was that woman from Louisiana, which is fine with me. If there's one identifier, I'll take Louisiana. And I want to talk, I get to do work for CL on an international level, on a national level, but I'm here today to actually talk about what the community is experiencing on the other side of these DOE loan and grant programs and what it has been like to be a person in the community that has access to some of these really deep analysis and experts. First off, I think one of the things that I want to keep this conversation grounded in, I promise, Pam, I'm not going to go over. So one of the things I want to keep this conversation grounded in is what these loan programs are funding. So, for example, there is a $4.5 billion blue hydrogen facility. They're calling it a blue hydrogen facility. This facility is actually taking in methane to produce ammonia and hydrogen using carbon capture and storage. That facility just actually submitted its air permit to the state of Louisiana just a couple months ago. And on that air permit, it is asking to release 42 tons per year of PM2.5, 31 tons per year of PM2.5. The first one was PM10. So 42 tons of PM10, 31 tons of PM2.5. That's particulate matter. That's air pollution. 87 tons of NOx. That is on top of releases of benzene, toluene, butadiene, methanol, and ammonia. And that is only part of the list. These are toxic air emissions. Benzene is a carcinogen. This facility is going into a community that is already overburdened by chemical and industrial facilities. So when we are talking about the money that is coming down from the federal government, we are talking about state and federal governments issuing permits to private corporations to contribute to air pollution. Period. That is what we are talking about. And I want us to stay grounded in that because particulate matter and air pollution causes at least 8 million excess deaths per year. And the largest responsible entity for that is fossil fuel corporations. And that is also going to be the largest benefactor of the IRA and the IIJA. On orders of magnitude, fossil fuel companies are getting much more money than, for instance, communities are getting. And this is something that we are concerned about. Now, those DOE loans and grants under the IRA and the IIJA require what are called community benefit plans. You guys may have heard about these. You probably haven't heard much beyond the word community benefit plans, and that's okay. The community hasn't either. I'm going to tell you what we've actually been told. There are four principles for these plans from the DOE, right? They engage communities in labor. They're supposed to provide ensure quality jobs. They're supposed to advance DEI in especially workforce training. And they're supposed to be Justice 40 initiatives, which, of course, is that 40% of the overall benefits from a facility flow to disadvantaged communities. That is supposed to be a requirement of all of these facilities, that they have a plan that ensures these four things. The minute the seven projects were announced, which I know is under a different office than yours, but the seven projects that were the hydrogen hub projects that were announced to move on to the next round of competitive funding that you were talking about, the minute those were announced, CL submitted a FOIA to the federal government asking for any conversations or details they could provide on community benefit plans. And that was 6 months ago. And we do not have an answer. The communities do not have an answer. We don't even know exactly where any of these facilities are supposed to go. We know that a lot of them are going to be very similar to that air products facility that I just read you the stats on about how much benzene and how much particulate matter they're putting into the air. We also know that the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council has advised the White House that carbon management of any kind, direct air capture, carbon capture and storage, is an environmental injustice and should not be prioritized by the administration. And we have seen them summarily ignored in that recommendation. Those recommendations are publicly available. They have held several public information sessions on them. I also, when you hear community benefits plan, right, the DOE has these four principles for a community benefits plan. Myself, as a community member, when I think of community benefits, I think of probably what you think of. A benefit to my community is clean air and water. A benefit to my community is essential service provisions. A benefit to my community is democratic and community-based decision-making. These are benefits. Good schools, clean roadways, safe roadways, parks. These are community benefits to us. None of those are required. And so far in the documentation we have, none of those are even being talked about in the DOE requirements for community benefits plans. The DOE is right now in the process of giving billions of dollars in public money to private corporations and granting them permits to emit carcinogenic chemicals into the air. And the only benefit that is ever discussed in any of these plans is jobs. And they're not even requiring that the jobs go to community members. They're not requiring that the jobs come with workforce development. They're allowing flexibility, which is so great, but what actually means that there is no requirement, which means communities will experience what we have always experienced from the fossil fuel corporations, which is that they say in the press release they're going to create 1,000 jobs. Then they say in their application to the state government, just kidding, we're actually only going to create 5. And then most of those jobs are filled by people from out of state, or they're temporary contract positions that don't have, for instance, union protection. And these are the consequences. These are the things that we are facing in the community, which is a real struggle. And I want to also acknowledge that the DOE is required to do community engagement through this process. And they've done that. The DOE has had virtual and in-person gatherings for community members for years. I have attended most of those gatherings, not just for the ones in the Gulf South, but also the ones, for instance, for the ARCH2 facility that's going to be nearby, the hydrogen hub that would be nearby. Those listening sessions have been attended by sometimes dozens of educated, informed community members. Community members whose main job is like special education teacher, who've had to learn how you break apart a methane into hydrogen in order to actually understand what the federal government is incentivizing these companies to put in their local communities. They have asked questions, smart, relevant, detailed questions, and not gotten answers. We still don't know what these facilities are, where they're going to be coming, what their water management plans are. We have no idea. But we do know from the other facilities who have filed air permits that almost every single one of these facilities is going to be emitting carcinogenic chemicals and particulate matter into the air. And there has not been nearly enough accountability for that. I want to I have a couple other points, but they'll come up in questions. I want to read one final thing. I want to talk about the direct air capture part of the IRA and the IIJA, which is just now, just within the last few weeks, they actually released the community benefits proposal for the community benefits plan. It's not an actual community benefits plan, but it is a document that says this is what the community benefits plan is going to do, maybe, for the direct air capture facility that DOE is providing, two direct air capture facilities in Louisiana and Texas that DOE is providing $1.6 billion to fund and incentivize. The Louisiana Project Cypress plan, this plan to make a plan includes words like identify, liaise, influence. It does not include words like decide or vote or go, no go. For months, communities have been told that we would have a go, no go input on where these facilities go, where this carbon gets injected, where these pipelines go, and that is not actually happening. It is not in the community benefits plan. They list the potential impacts: land use, environmental impacts, traffic increases, noise pollution, health and safety of workers and residents, air quality, CO2 pipeline risks, light pollution, energy use, water use, waste runoff, emergency responders being unprepared, and, quote, any other air, soil, or water impacts as the potential negative impacts of this facility. And the only benefit mentioned in that plan to make a community benefits plan is jobs. There's no other benefit mentioned. And I want to read one final sentence, which is on the tribal section. They say Project Cypress will plan to ensure that any affected tribes expressing interest in engagement are engaged during the initial phase. And if that is not the most non-committal sentence I've ever read, this is what communities are facing from the DOE. And this is a serious concern. Thank you.
Jagar, would you like, as the representative of the federal government, to respond at all to that?
I'm happy to, but why don't we just have the rest of the panel go and then...
Okay, great. Yeah. All right, so next, Kelsey Tamburino, who's a reporter, and Jesse Blazer, amazing work they've done at Politico. These guys are the real deal. So they're going to present what they've been doing and how they've been tracking it and how you can track it.
Yeah, thank you all for coming to this event. So, you know, when we're talking about the bipartisan infrastructure law and the IRA, it's really in three buckets of loans, which Jigar has talked about, and that's money that is repaid to the federal government. There's federal grants, which do not have to be repaid, and then there's tax credits. And that's an area I personally spend a lot of time tracking, and I would just want to talk a little bit about the IRA in that sense. The lion's share of the IRA climate benefits are coming from those tax credits, and they're uncapped is what most of them are uncapped, and that is why you'll often see Republicans criticize these tax credits, because we don't know the total cost of them at this point. And they're kind of a black box in terms of who is claiming them, and there is some insight we can provide into to see who, you know, where we're seeing some of the announcements so far, and get some line of sight into the companies that are looking at these tax credits. But just in broad sense, I want to kind of level set what is in these tax credits, right? There are extensions, 10-year long-term extensions for tax credits for solar and wind that have long helped the industry kind of grow. And these they basically start at a base tax credit, which is very wonky and confusing, but for the most part, if projects meet prevailing wage, they pay the prevailing wage, and they're in utilize apprenticeships, and in that program, they can increase their value of their tax credit fivefold. And then on top of that, what's unique to the IRA is there are stackable credits. So if you locate your project in a low-income community, in an energy community, which is like a community previously dependent on fossil fuels, or if you use U.S.-made steel, iron, manufactured product, you can increase the value of those credits. So that's important context when you're seeing debates over some of these, the implementation from the Treasury Department of how this is being written, because it really has the potential to be quite lucrative for companies looking to take advantage of that. They're also not just solar and wind. We have tax credits to clean hydrogen for carbon capture, as was mentioned. There is incentives for nuclear, for sustainable aviation fuel. And so a lot of the debate we're seeing is how those rules are written and how the administration is going to account for the emissions from that and balance the environmental concerns, as well as the need to deploy as much energy as possible to reach our climate targets. On top of that, there's two other things I want to note before I let Jesse kind of explain how to track some of these grants, is that there is a wholesale change in how credit monetization is happening in these tax credits, and that is in the sense that, you know, we've long heard from, I should back up a little bit, but the companies that typically use these tax credits, they do so by relying on banks, and that requires them to have tax liability for communities like municipalities, for tribal communities, for local entities that don't have that tax liability, it's difficult. So in the debate for this tax, for the IRA, which is long, long running, for folks who was tracking on the Hill, it was died many times, and I did not think sometimes it was going to happen, but there was a lot of debate, including what is called direct pay, and that is basically a direct payment from the federal government, and that, as it's being implemented, is really a wholesale change to allow communities that have previously not benefited from tax credits to utilize these tax credits. And that is, their Treasury has finalized some regulations on that front, so that's something that communities for the first time are looking at, how to use tax credits to invest in clean energy projects. There's also something called, and I should say that's only available for certain tax credits, some other tax credits in the law, and that you can thank Joe Manchin for that. There's other tax credits in the law that are they're known as transferability, and you can transfer a tax liable entity, can transfer it to another tax liable entity, and that is also a game changer in the sense that, you know, it really expands the pool of companies and developers that are looking at these tax credits. Additionally, I will also note that thanks to Ron Wyden on the Senate side, who has really advocated for a tech neutral approach to tax credits, in the year 2025, a lot of these tax credits are going to shift into a tech-neutral framework, basically, which is going to tie those tax credits to their emissions reduction. So that's kind of, there's many things we can talk about with the tax credits, but I would just note those are the kind of big things that I think are worth tracking when we're talking about new communities looking at these tax credits, but also why they are so lucrative. And we are already seeing, as I'm sure many people have seen, the administration tout the many announcements from these tax credits, and that is often in the manufacturing space, but we're seeing, you know, clean energy solar projects moving forward with the anticipation of utilizing these tax credits. And so, you know, how many of those get built, and like the questions around where these projects are going is very valid and worth reporting further, but just to let folks know, we are already seeing interest and growth stemming from these tax credits. And then I will pass it off to Jesse.
Hi, guys. Can y'all hear me okay? I'm Jesse. I'm a data reporter with Politico, where I cover energy and sustainability. Today, I'm going to get up from my seat in just a second and go over to the podium and take you guys through a couple of data resources that I think are very reporter-friendly, no matter what your literacy is with data reporting or your experience working with it. That helps you see where this money is going when it comes to direct federal spending. So Kelsey just helped me also understand how all of the tax credits work, which is a very complicated bucket of money with a lot of nuance. Like she mentioned, tax credits themselves are very hard to track, and a lot of that information we just don't know yet because of the tax deadline. So we're not really going to be talking about that when it comes to data, but we are going to look at the wealth of data that's available for direct federal spending across all of these different bills. And I'll take you guys through that. So I'm going to go over there.
Winning.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is exactly the point. So when you guys go to this right-hand side of this, the page, you're going to see a lot of really big numbers. We have almost $700 billion in manufacturing investments. This refers to those private investments, so the first part of the map that was a little bit less sparse than this, but still heavily populated. Then we get to this number, almost $480 billion in announced investments. This is referring to direct federal spending. So there's one thing that I want to call out here just to make sure we're understanding what this data is saying. When you look at this breakdown of the $480 billion, we see $301 billion here announced, $41.5 announced, $23.1 also announced, and then the next one also announced. Announced spending is a part of the process. That reflects the fact that the federal government, whatever agency is doling out awards, has gotten to a certain point with those recipients where they have announced an award. That does not necessarily mean that they have obligated that money, that they have actually awarded it or promised that they will spend it. Oftentimes, that award is still in a phase of negotiation. So it does reflect some amount of movement on the federal government side, and it is worth looking into more if one of these announcements is coming to your community. But this is not to say that all of these recipients have spent almost $580 billion in the communities. That is not the case and would not be fair to conclude from this data. So I just want to make sure that everybody understands that when you look at this data, because it is really helpful. Like, you can go to your own state, you can see how these numbers change when you look at your own state, but just know that context, that announced spending does This was a new resource for me about 5 months ago. I had never used it before, and now I'm possibly its biggest fan and greatest nemesis at the same time. It is the premier government resource for federal spending of all kinds. So if you have any questions about government spending, I would definitely direct you to this site, to USA Spending, to see if you can get those questions answered. And it also has some really good helpful tools for looking specifically at the IIJA or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. So when you go to USA Spending, you're going to come to this page. It's very straightforward. You just press Start Searching Award Data. This is the little tidbit that is helpful if you are interested in bill funding. You're going to go, you have all of these search terms, and we're not going to go through all of them. Like I said, do a whole class on this. But what you want to pay attention to is this right here, something called the Disaster Emergency Fund Code, or DEFC value. This is a code that's assigned by the Office of Management and Budget for specific funding sources, so essentially pieces of legislation that have become law. You can go down to this tab. We've got a lot of COVID spending options here. They're all given letters. I don't know why that is. But if you scroll all the way down, you get to infrastructure spending. There's two for emergency spending, I think, and non-emergency, yeah. Both of those, even though it says infrastructure spending, which is kind of broad, this does refer to the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. So you click on those, and then you press submit, and then it's going to bring you to this very long page, and we've got, you know, direct payments, we've got grants, we've got all sorts of things to look at. When you click on an individual award ID, you're taken to an award page. So if you are reporting on where you live, your community, and you want to find the awards that have actually come to your community and know how much has been obligated, so how much has been awarded by the federal government, what they promised to pay that recipient, and how much that recipient has actually spent on whatever project it is that they are working on, this is the place to go. Yes, that's outlay. Exactly. So obligations is the award, and outlay is what has been spent by your recipient. You have all sorts of helpful information on these award pages. Like, you've got some start dates and end dates for a project. You've got a project description, which this is a great example of when that project description is not helpful. Sometimes this might look like an intentional empty space, but it's not. Sometimes this is three paragraphs long, and other times it's two words. So there's lots of variability there. That's one of the drawbacks of USA Spending, but, you know, you take what you can get. There's lots of other detail to go into on USA Spending, but I do just want to make sure that everybody knows that you can look specifically at bill funding as a whole on this website, and that has been super helpful to me, and I think it can be helpful to a lot of people. Okay, so great question. Projects can have multiple funding sources. So this particular example is kind of a good one, because if you look at this little chart that they have here, we've got overall spending, COVID-19 spending, and infrastructure spending. These tabs reflect, in this case, different funding sources. COVID-19 spending is American Rescue Plan, and then infrastructure spending is bill spending. So this particular award for the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the obligated amount is $3.4 million from that funding source, and in this particular case, they've spent that entire amount of the award. But when we look at this project's overall spending, we see different numbers. So overall, $4 billion, a very, very small subset of that, $3.4 million, came from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. So sometimes this is confusing. This would be a confusing case where you've got multiple funding streams. You can also have state-level funding. If it's a state project, it's all coming together here. But other times, you have a very straightforward, like, bill paid in full for this award, and that's the one funding stream. So that's a great question. Okay. Those are our government resources. Now, we're going to go on to non-government resources for data, which there are some great ones that you guys can use and take advantage of depending on what your needs are. So some more fun to reach out. Okay. The first one that I'm going to take you guys to is the Center for American Progress Tracker. This one, I'm just going to briefly show you what it looks like. This is the CAP tracker. You have all of these different search terms over here, which is helpful. I would say that this website is the most helpful if your goal is to say, hey, I don't necessarily know what I want to report on for all of this infrastructure money coming into my area, but I want to know what's going on. what E2 has done here is tracked private investment announcements since the IRA was passed to show where those announcements are, how much they promised, if they promised jobs, how many jobs they promised, and what sector they're in. So if that is specifically what you're interested in, this is a great resource for that. You are able to go to this site and download a full project-by-project data set, which will also give you some more location information, which is helpful. Then you can also get state-level summaries and sector-level summaries that are just good for that. You need a number to create context in your reporting. Lastly, we've got the Clean Investment Auditor. This is a project from Rhodium Group and from MIT. I'm going to take you to their database. They also track private investments as well as public investments more holistically, I think, than, well, not necessarily holistically, more broadly than E2 does, which is specifically looking at investments after IRA was passed. As you can see from the dates here, Clean Investment Monitor goes back a little bit more. So the one thing that I'll say about them is that they have a very long and detailed methodology, and they have great information that can be helpful for creating context because they have estimated things like who could be taking advantage of tax credits, either on the private company side and on the consumer side. And they've also estimated outlays across all of these, or across IIJA and the IRA, which is something that we don't necessarily get with other resources, but it's an estimation. So it's important to read that methodology and to understand how they came to the conclusion that they did, so that if you agree with it and you feel like that's a fair way to go about it, then sure, go ahead and include it in your reporting. But if not, then it's not the best resource for you. But they do offer this great sort of interface to show you guys how things have changed over time. I will say that their database itself is not available for public download. You have to reach out to them and sign like a use agreement, so also something to keep in mind. But if you're just looking for quick context or you yourself want to get a feel for what's going on, Clean Investment Monitor is great. But again, read that methodology.
Is there another tool? What is the quickest way to kind of get an overview, or if you're looking for something quick?
I would say the best thing to do a quick resource on is to stick to invest.gov, to be honest, even though it's the context of announced versus actually obligated or outlaid or slash spent is something to keep in mind there. Invest.gov being a White House resource is something that is a good fallback. And they do a great job of collecting all of those announcements from all of these different agencies, because even me, like, it is very hard to keep up with all of the different announcements coming from everybody, and they have done that work for you. So if you just want context on what people have said that they will do, then invest.gov is a great resource, and also those state-by-state reports in that drop-down are helpful.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
So I am going to ask our panelists a few questions, and then we'll move to audience questions. So Jigar, I won't ask that entire question. I'd like to answer Jane. But how are like communities being protected when we're talking about, you know, multi-billion, multi-million dollar investments? How are the communities being protected?
No, I love Jane's question, and I'm happy to engage. Although I'm not sure we have enough time to get through all of it, but I think I want to make sure that we remind folks that this is a process conversation. As I said before, this country really hasn't done these kinds of big commercialization efforts here for many, many decades, right? And so now we're trying to figure out how we do it here, right? And so part of what DOE has said is that there's a process to getting it done. And as Jesse suggested, a lot of this money has been selected, I think is the terminology that we use, not yet awarded, which means that there's actually a contract signed. And then even after it's awarded, like there's a bunch of milestones that they have to hit to draw that capital over time, right? Whether it's the hydrogen hubs or DAC hubs, et cetera, right? And so as someone who takes this very seriously, we have community benefits plans for all of our projects. There are always some version of terrible. What we do is we go into the community and actually ask people. And frankly, a lot of the community members don't quite know how to engage. And so we actually hold meetings and say, here's what we'd like feedback on and what do you want to do, et cetera, et cetera. They might say, we don't trust our local elected leaders. We'd like to make sure the money that is provided to the community, has an independent board or whatever it is. This is the feedback I got from the river parishes the last time I was there. And so we're not allowed as the Department of Energy to sort of run roughshod over all of these folks and say, this is what you shall do from a top-down basis. But we are capable of making sure these conversations are happening and are productive and go through these things, right? I don't think that you want someone like me making these decisions for communities, right? You don't want me saying, well, this particular voice hasn't been heard properly or this particular person hasn't been reflected in the comments, et cetera. So there has to be some deference that's provided by us, but we can absolutely make sure that the process is a robust process so that folks can go all the way through. And I just want to make sure that we're being crystal clear that from the time that people apply for something to the time that they're selected, the vast majority of that time period is covered by the Trade Secrets Act. So I can't talk to anybody during that period of time, right? So even if someone said, I know this group applied and I want to talk to you about it, I'm not allowed to talk to that person about it, right? It's not until I, in my parlance, provide a conditional commitment, which is just a glorified term sheet, that the loan becomes public. And then I'm able to actually talk to people during a period of time before we close the loan. And then we're not even advancing dollars yet. We're still closing the loan and advancing. So I think that that process is the part that we're leaning into very heavily.
Just a quick note on the trade secrets. Has that always been the case for these – okay, because yeah. That seems to be a big issue. Okay, Jane.
I just add one thing. Okay. The vast majority – well – I'm not going to say the vast majority. I love the fact that infrastructure is being built out. There are incredible things that are going to benefit the communities, the coastal communities across the United States that are facing sea level rise, that are facing increasingly extreme weather, particularly my community in Louisiana. I grew up on one end of Cancer Alley, and I currently live on the other, and I drink the tap water, which is a conversation we can have later. And so this is very, very real and close to home to me, and I am very, very supportive of this process, of exactly what you're talking about in terms of the commercialization effort, and that is huge, and it is big, and it is one of the best benefits that communities have ever had. But most of the hype we hear coming out of the administration about the climate impacts of the IRA and the BIL are about hydrogen and carbon capture and storage. And when we are over-focusing on hydrogen, DAC, and CCS, that is a form of climate misinformation because none of those things have actually been proven to effectively reduce carbon in the atmosphere. And in many cases, like blue hydrogen, it actually increases the amount of carbon in the atmosphere while communities are being told this is a climate investment. And, oh, yeah, we just issued this company a permit to increase local pollution and toxic chemical emissions. So this is part of our concern is, like, bring all of the good. Bring all of the repair and the restoration and the energy efficiency and the solar panels and the wind. But to bring these toxic chemicals, these carcinogenic emitters into communities and tell us this is a climate solution is just not going to cut it. Even as I'm like, yeah, infrastructure. I'm also like, good infrastructure. And that is what we're pushing for.
Okay, Kelsey.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how Republicans are responding to this. Is there going to be a pushback? Is there going to be a move to reduce this funding? And then if you want to touch upon the potential of administrative changes.
Yeah, happy to. As much as this is a climate environmental justice story, it's also a political story. Mm-hmm. And with the IRA, this is a bill that passed with only Democratic support. And what we have done in our reporting is find that a lot of these manufacturing investment or announcements that we've seen on this map are going to Republican-held districts from lawmakers that did not vote to pass the IRA. And with that said, in our reporting, we've tried to go to some of these communities, Republican communities, and we've heard, you know, varying responses from some lawmakers who want the jobs and they support the jobs. They'll credit their local government for getting the tax incentives, which is notable. There are federal tax incentives. There are also state tax incentives that are supporting a lot of these projects, particularly in the Southeast. And so, you know, you'll see governors say they want the jobs and they do back the investments we're seeing from the federal government. They'll criticize the process of getting these tax credits and these incentives. But they are supportive in some communities. We also traveled for a story we wrote to New York in a Biden district represented by a Republican who represented an area that used to be home to an IBM factory, that 7,000 jobs that left, and now they're looking to put a battery plant there. And there are, of course, community concerns over what that means for the environment, the water quality, but there also is support for the jobs from the folks that we talk to. And those members will say, the Republican members who did not vote for it, they'll say it was a messaging bill and they would want those incentives to stay in that particular community. In other communities, of course, there are folks who are attempting to repeal the IRA. That is something we've seen legislation on the Hill before. Some of it's wholesale repeal, some of it's targeted specific tax credits, but that is something we should expect to continue, particularly as we ramp up to the election. We'll also note, I traveled to a community in Michigan, and one area where I do hear pushback is when these investments are linked to China. That's where we'll hear concern. And I went to one community where they ousted a Republican local board because of a battery plant that was linked to China and they had concerns about. And, you know, it really divided the community. Some were really opposed to this plant over these concerns over China. Others wanted the jobs and really accused their neighbors of fear-mongering and xenophobia, and that is a debate that was playing out and is still playing out. There's now a lawsuit. So there's a lot of local community stories to tell here and a lot of different nuances in the tax credits. In terms of repeal, I think most folks will tell you there will not be a wholesale repeal of the IRA, but there will be a scalpel-like approach to this, and we will certainly still see attempts to do so. I think where there are more vulnerabilities, it's those tax credits that you hear a lot about. The electric vehicle tax credit in particular is one that you could see targeted. The tech-neutral tax credits, some of these bonus tax credits, the energy efficiency consumer tax credits are areas Republicans will often point to. So, you know, there is also could be attempts to, you know, unwind some of the rulemaking. So there's definitely a lot to track there. I think most people would expect, again, that it's not going to be a wholesale repeal, but there will certainly be fights ongoing for the rest of the year and if we see a change in administration or the makeup on the Hill.
Great. Jagar, do you want to address the issue of what happens if we have a change in administration? Okay, is that something you can...
I can start.
Or like, you know, how things are moving, progressing. Is there a rush to get some of these loans and these programs approved before then?
Yeah, let me start. I mean, I think as Kelsey and Jesse know well, the only way to actually, repeal the Loan Programs Office or anything else is through an act of Congress. And I don't think that they expect that to occur. But so I don't think that's what we're talking about here. I think separately, what they've said is that the amount of interest in taking American innovation and turning it into commercialization, as Jane was discussing as well, is bipartisan, right? I mean, it clearly defined the 2016 election and now has defined the 2020 election and will clearly define this election. So I think that people want that story. Now, there are certain sectors that folks are pro and certain sectors people are against, and we can have that dialogue. But I think the notion that America has been the place where most of the patents have been filed, where most of the breakthroughs have been discovered, whether it's solar panels or wind turbines or whatever else, but we basically gave up the ability to manufacture those things here and left those technologies go to other continents for scale-up. I think that concept has been fully approved by everybody. Everyone wants our technologies that we ourselves have paid to actually create jobs here, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that part of it, I think, is really bipartisan. The other thing I would say is that, you know, part of the challenge with these programs is that we don't have a 40-plus year history of industrial strategy in this country, right? So one of the challenges that you have in terms of different administrations, et cetera, is where that expertise comes from and whether that expertise will remain if another administration comes in, right? Because this is complex stuff, right? I mean, and I certainly have a point of view which is centered around innovators and entrepreneurs, but other people have different points of view, right? Which are more top down or other things. And so part of the challenge you're going to have around the election is whether the signals that are being sent to Wall Street and investors and community groups and others are going to stay the same or whether those the rules are going to be changed, and then the way that the investments occur end up changing as well.
Just one more question to Jane, and then we'll open it up. Jane, so considering your opposition to some of the programs with the IRA, what do you expect to happen if there's another administration? And I mean, considering your concerns about CCS, and you know, you'd be like, hey, yay, IRA is gone.
This is a question that we're wrestling with a lot, not just in Louisiana, but at CL broadly, about, you know, we are a human rights and climate environmental organization. We would like to see policies that are actually moving us toward reducing greenhouse gas emissions, us being the U.S., but also the world, toward reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We want to see deployment of things like renewable energy, including wind and solar, electrification, energy efficiency, that actually reduce the load, that improve the grid, that source more of our energy worldwide from renewable energy sources. We obviously, we are a 501c3 organization, so I'm going to not make super intense comments on that. But what we are seeing is that the support for what we know to be false solutions, like carbon capture and storage and hydrogen, that support is bipartisan. The story of Louisiana is actually that we are moving forward so earnestly with CCS and hydrogen and direct air capture because of our Democratic governor, who was term limited, and we now have a Republican governor in Louisiana. And we have a Republican supermajority in the Louisiana state legislature, and they are now talking about rewriting Louisiana's constitution this summer. So we are in a constitutional crisis in Louisiana as well, which has major implications for the country and for the world's climate because of all of the industrial emissions that come out of Louisiana. Upwards of 80% of our state emissions are from industry, which is way above average. I think the average is in the teens of state-level emissions coming from industry, and Louisiana's is close to 80%. So it's very dramatic, the amount of industrial emissions that Louisiana is carrying for not just the country but the world. I want to put one piece of information on the table. Like, when we are talking about the future of the energy system, I think what we have to keep in mind is that renewable energy at this point is the most economically sensible move toward not just reducing climate emissions, but toward producing energy. Solar and wind energy are now cheaper to deploy than fossil fuel-based energy. So we are in a place where we are scrambling to give public money to prop up what is a dinosaur of an industry, and I mean that literally and figuratively, for the oil and gas industry. And, you know, there's a statistic that's in a publication that CL put out at the end of last year about direct air capture, and it's one that really brings it home for me. The direct air capture facility that they're planning in Texas, which is an Occidental Petroleum, it's called Stratos Direct Air Capture Facility. It's a $1 billion facility in Texas. It's supposed to reduce around 200,000 tons of CO2 a year, right? You can get the same reduction in CO2, the same prevention, actually, in CO2 emissions by building 54 wind turbines. And you can do it at a seventh of the cost right now. And that is dramatic when we think about the economic implications. So when you ask me about future political administrations and how we think about that, on some level, the politics matter, but I mean, on many, all levels, the politics matter, but the economics also matter. And it is very, very clear that right now, the most economically sensible, the most market-driven, and the most obvious choice is to build out solar, wind, and renewable energy, and to not be propping up a dying industry, which is the fossil fuel industry.
Okay, we're going to open up questions, reporters first, and if you can just speak loudly, because I'm not sure if our mic's going to work, in the back there.
I'm curious about the workforce component. It seems like a major challenge, actually having people to build these plans and deploy these technologies and everything. What kind of money is in there? How is it doing? It seems like a really big challenge.
Is that to me?
Yeah, go for it. Okay.
So as part of the community benefits plans, we asked them to answer that question. I'd say that there's a couple pieces. I'd say the vast majority, I think it's close to 90% of all of our loans are using union construction labor, and so they've got 1,700 training centers around the country, and they're actively recruiting high school students and others to come in and become apprentices. And you know, there's a big framework within the IRA around, as Kelsey was suggesting, some of these bonuses around the tax credits and other things. And so I think that's happening. I think the one thing that we have been very actively involved in is just the micro efforts around exactly how you use the technical colleges, mm-hmm. how you use the community colleges, how you figure out like whether those are the right areas to do, or whether you want to do it from high school directly, since most, you know, high schools have given up on vocational training and some of that stuff. And so some of the loans that we provided, the companies have actually funded vocational training back into high schools in those areas. Some of them are funding directly into the things. There's matching dollars out of the Department of Labor and some other places. But like, but I would say to you that this is not something that is happening on the macro level. This is something happening at a very micro level. So mm-hmm. each one of the companies is working directly with the states, with the county, with the local school districts, et cetera, to put these, because the money's there. There's like matching dollars and $50,000 to help like the curriculum for that particular technical college, et cetera, et cetera. But the challenge with all of those people is they want to make sure that they're not training people that won't have a job, mm-hmm. right? So they don't really want to do it unless there's a company that's saying we're going to hire 80% of the graduates out of this program, right? And so we're very involved in there, and this is another place where we frankly haven't been good at this for many decades. And so we're bringing in best practices and all these other things. And I don't think we're done yet. I think it's an ongoing conversation in each place. But it's a place where the community benefits plans come in. They're weak, I would suggest. And then we are working to strengthen them to make them, because it's a big risk of our loan, right? I mean, if you don't have quality workers, then you're not going to get to the outcomes.
Okay.
I would just add real quickly, with the tax credits, right, with putting these investments in formerly coal, natural gas areas, the administration is hoping to retool, you know, those workers into a clean field. And I think there's a lot of further reporting to do there in terms of can an offshore oil worker transition easily to an offshore wind job. And there's a lot of emphasis on those sort of transitions. And I think in terms of reporting, there's a lot more to do there in terms of that training, how that works, if there's even interest from those workers to move to these jobs. And I think, you know, that's a point of emphasis we've heard from the administration, is definitely something to further report out.
Okay. Can you identify identify yourself and your outlet?
Yeah. First, let me just say that, like, it warms my heart that, like, I'm a solar entrepreneur and Jane is, like, super excited. And I see Clint there, and Clint, like, believed in me in 2003 when nobody else did. And so the fact that we're talking about solar and wind being the cheapest form of electricity today is, like, a big deal. And I think DOE had a huge role in getting it there. And so I think, first of all, we need to celebrate wins. And I think we also need to, like remember forest and trees. Right. I mean, it literally, actually, in some cases, but, you know, 80% of everything that's being added to our grid today is clean, mm-hmm. right? Like 80% of everything that's getting added to our grid today. And sometimes it's 87%. Sometimes it's like 79%, but it's like 80%. So I think we first have to start there. Then we have to go to the next layer down, which I think Kelsey, like, sort of not just insinuated, but said, is that, like, you know, this bill was passed by a set of people that got a certain set of votes, mm-hmm. right? And so it is my job at the Department of Energy to implement the laws that are passed by our elected officials, right? And so it is not my job to say, like, this is my favorite technology. This is my least favorite technology. This is my medium favorite technology. Like, it is my job to say, these are the programs that were passed in the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and it is my job to make sure that they're implemented with the level of professionalism that Congress and the U.S. taxpayers expect, right? And so that is my job. But separately, as I suggested earlier, the DOE is suggesting that we need to get community buy-in, that we need to figure out all these pieces in the community benefits plan, right? And so we are insisting that all of these folks go back and take their first draft that I often read and make them better. And we are working with the communities to say the way in which this engagement has occurred is not sufficient. We need it to have more engagement, right? And you've seen that process get started in a very intense way with hydrogen hubs and other things. And we are early days in that process, right? And so that is the process by which these, like, sort of get these things get adjudicated. You don't want it to be adjudicated where a government bureaucrat says, like, this is the provision I like the most and this is the provision I don't like the most.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say to finish the question with tax credit. That's where it becomes tough to say, because the tax credits are a place where we just have the least amount of information. And Climate Investment Monitor, they have estimations on use of tax credits, which is helpful to know how they might be being used by, you know, private corporations and consumers. But you're not getting an actual itemized list of, like, who has used it, what did they get, when did they apply for it, whatever. So you can't really. Like, I think we're at a point where we don't have enough information to flag abuse because we don't even know who's receiving that money yet. And that's not to say that it's a problem that we don't know. Like, it is too early to know. So I think it is something to keep a pulse on, especially to see when and if the Treasury is able to provide more transparency on how those tax credits get used, and especially by tax credit, which is what I would love to see, to be able to ask for the most detailed data that you can so that you, if there is a moment of possible abuse, that you could identify it. But it's too early to say right now.
One of the things that the IRA is really significantly incentivizing is carbon capture and storage, right? The entire story about hydrogen being a climate solution, at least hydrogen made from methane, which the vast majority of it is right now, is the idea that you can capture the carbon and store it. The 45Q tax credit that is actually what pays corporations to capture and bury that carbon. Before IRA, there was an analysis done on the way that 45Q tax credits were distributed and how and what the abuse was within that system. And not only did they find that 80% of 45Q was going toward enhanced oil recovery, which means they were using the carbon paid for under 45Q to get more oil out of the ground, which then releases more greenhouse gases. I don't know if you knew that. That was a joke. Sorry, you guys know a lot. But they also found that upwards of 80% of those, the funds from 45Q that went to oil and gas companies were actually ill-gotten. They were not filed in the right way. They were not given for the right thing. And there was a lot of accountability that had to go to corporations for that. And then they more than doubled the incentives for CCS under the IRA for both EOR and permanent storage. And when I say there was a lot of accountability, I mean there was like a couple of days of a news cycle and then they doubled the incentives. So we haven't actually seen where that kind of thing is going to be analyzed or prevented in the future. And the only reason we even know about that abuse right now is because of the work of journalists and NGOs.
Jagar, how is that money being managed and how are you making sure that it is being spent properly? What are the, you know, safeguards put in place?
I'm sorry, you mean tax credits, grants?
Tax credit grant, well, the loan program, obviously. But how are you ensuring through that loan program that the money's getting spent how you intend to? Or is it still a little too early?
Well, so the loan program, I think, is the one area that I think everyone has a lot of.
And also ask, like, how do you balance the speed of getting that money out the door versus making sure it's sent to the right place?
So. Yeah, so I mean, I think that the loan program is the one place where I think no one is concerned about how we're spending the money. I think we have had the most intense scrutiny of any program in like human history. And so in general, I'd say, you know, we just put out our annual report of all of our loans, exactly what's happening with each one of them. If you read it, it actually gives you gory detail on the ones that are like on the watch list and what's wrong with those projects and how we're like fixing those projects and all that stuff. So I would say that the one office that is not accused ever of a lack of transparency, I think, is our office. So I don't think that part is the challenge. And then separately, in terms of oversight, we have a lot, right? Whether it's Senate, but also like the Office of Management and Budget, Treasury. And so even if I wanted to rush a loan through the Loan Programs Office, it's actually not possible. So there are a lot of things I have to do to get full sign-off, including, internal folks within DOE, et cetera. So I don't think anyone is really accusing us, except rhetorically, of pushing money out the door quickly. It's not really possible for us to do that. I think the big thing with the broad programs is that there's actually a lot of people looking over our shoulder. It's not just Jane, thank you.
You're welcome.
But it's also the Government Accountability Office, the Internal Inspector General at DOE, et cetera. So, I mean, I think that as someone who has never taken a DOE loan or grant in my career, even though I've done a lot of stuff in energy, coming into DOE, like the amount of professionalism, having like independent reviewers of each application that everyone does just to make sure that like when the GAO audit comes, which they all know is going to come, that the paperwork is ready to go and everyone can audit it and everything else, like, is truly impressive. So I really don't think that part of it's the problem. I think the part of it that is the biggest problem is whether we actually know how to commercialize technologies in this country. Because we can provide a grant, but then we provide a grant, that facility gets created, and then if it goes bankrupt 2 years later, well, then it went bankrupt 2 years later, right? And so how we actually organize between NGOs and workforce training and communities and then state incentives and federal incentives to make sure that we actually can manufacture this stuff here, that we can compete with countries around the world, that we can do all those things, I think is a far less appreciated, you know, challenge that we're facing right now.
Mm-hmm. I think we have time for one or two.
We have time for one or two more questions.
Hi, my name is Lee Berner. I'm with Chemical and Engineering News. My question is for Jesse. The Environmental Defense Fund also has an IRA and infrastructure tracker. Is that one worth using, and in what context?
I actually haven't looked at EDF's tracker as much. I know that they do a lot of great data work. They provide a lot of great insight and context into what is going on broadly, whether it's specifically with the spending or their climate vulnerability index, lots of great things. So I'll get back to you on that. But I can't imagine, my advice broadly on any data resource is the very first thing you need to do after just looking at the data and sort of digesting what a map is saying or what the charts are saying is read the data notes and the methodology. Because I think that regardless of whatever recommendations you get from anybody else, if you do that, then you can have a discussion with, you know, internally with yourself and with your editors about, this is how they calculated X. Do we agree with that? Is that fair? And if it is, then you should proceed with using that type of data. And also, even if data seems obvious of like what the conclusion is, I would always recommend reaching out to the data source itself and talking with them and just saying, hey, this is what I'm getting from this. This is the conclusion that I've reached. Just want to make sure that that's right. Because oftentimes there is nuance in data that is not obvious. And that's just a good best practice to carry with you with whatever resource you're using.
All right, one last question, anyone? Oh.
Curious about how you factor that in. Obviously, we hear a lot about what's the next Solyndra. So how do you factor that in when making decisions, and what would you say is the biggest challenge to getting the money out the door more quickly, especially in light of the upcoming election?
I think I've been pretty transparent about it. I'm in a fortunate position where, like, I don't get affected by political tax, et cetera. I've done well in the private sector before coming in. In general, I'd say that the biggest challenge that we have is just the fact that this ecosystem doesn't really exist, right? That for 10 years or so, the office was dormant. And so, like, the consultants that help people write applications don't exist. Like, the applicants don't actually know how to get through our office. They don't have a friend who's gone through the office, right? So when I say, you still haven't filled out the paperwork correctly, I can't give you a loan unless you do it properly. They can't go around and fix it the next day. So everyone's like, well, why are you taking so long? I was like, because I'm not allowed to just give you a loan because I like you. Like, you have to actually fill out the paperwork properly. Like, you have to do all this stuff, right? And so I think our applicants have been heroically unprepared for the effort that they have to go through and they're much better today than they were 2 years ago. And we've done a lot of work on that and been very transparent on our blog. And, you know, we have like the top 10 things people do wrong on their applications, on their blog, et cetera. So I think we work really hard on there, but I don't think this is a political challenge. I think it's really just America learning how to use these muscles again around how we do big things in this country. I think there are a lot of people who really just discount our ability to do big things. Like, regularly, mm-hmm. right? We can't build transmission. There's no way to like figure this out. We can't do that. And I was like, what are we doing? Like, we have the smartest people in the country. Like, we have the best technology providers, the best union workers, all these other things. Yes, we have not like attempted to do these big things in our country for a little while, but we absolutely can do it. I think that's actually my biggest challenge, is people not believing in themselves enough to come to me for like a $2 billion project that they so desperately want to build, but they're worried about whether they can do it, right? And their investors are worried about whether they can do it. And the local government's worried about whether they can do it. And I was like, try, like, you can do it. Like, let's figure this out.
Just to connect one thing, so talking about, I think you're absolutely right that we have forgotten in America how to flex our muscles to do big things and to do big things using our collective government power. I am deeply pro-government. I also live right now one house off of Claiborne Avenue, which is actually, we call it Claiborne Avenue, but it's a highway that runs through New Orleans. And the Claiborne Expressway is the bridge that actually carries Claiborne Avenue, a major highway that connects to Interstate 10 through the city of New Orleans. Claiborne Avenue was actually part of one of the big things that we did in the 40s and 50s when the federal government was incentivizing building major wide highways through poor black communities all over this country. The Claiborne Avenue Expressway decimated the Treme neighborhood in New Orleans, and that community is still trying to maintain culture and has been disadvantaged for 60 years because of the construction of that expressway. And we are now in conversation to tear it down. And that is happening all over the country, taking down these expressways that were built as part of this big thing that happened in the 40s and 50s because we weren't transparent about what the impacts on communities were going to be of these big projects, right? I don't want that to be happening again. I don't want a future generation of New Orleans to have to tear down the big things that we are doing right now because we didn't properly evaluate how damaging they were going to be at the time. So I'm deeply pro big thing, but we should have built high-speed rail between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, not the Claiborne Avenue Expressway. And I think that that is generally accepted. You know, you can tell that story about New York City. You can tell that story about Baltimore, though don't talk about bridges in Baltimore right now. It's a touchy subject. You can tell, I know, I'm sorry. You can tell that story about a lot of communities across the United States that we should be doing big things, and we should not be doing them at the expense of poor, disadvantaged black or brown communities, period. Thank you.
All right, I think that concludes everything for today, unless Kelsey or Jesse, you guys have any concluding? Okay, great. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Enjoy the rest of your conference, and